What's up, everybody? Welcome back to In My Non-Expert Opinion. I'm your host, Chelsea Reif, and I also help people launch and grow their podcasts as a podcast strategist. Now, I've run this podcast since 2017, and it wasn't until really the last year, probably like 2022 to 2023, that I've traveled at a pace that I've never traveled before and run a business at a level I've never run a business before. So I know that can be really interesting. Like, how do you do that? And so that's what today's episode is. Like, how do I travel full-time while running a business? Before we get into it, I have done episodes in the past about this, about remote work, as well as how to travel abroad for cheap, how I lived in Australia during the coronavirus and lockdown in Germany. There are a ton of episodes between like 2020 to pretty much last year that I've definitely sprinkled in travel stories. But this one is a dedicated deep dive into how I travel full-time and run my business. And just a reminder before we get into all the nitty-gritty details, and we will, by the way, so you definitely want to go get a notebook, is that if you leave a review this month, I'm going to enter you into a giveaway to win a 20-minute laser coaching session with me. This session can be about traveling, whether that's traveling full-time, or if you want to do a one-month away program, or if you want to talk about podcasting and how I can help you with your podcast, storytelling, marketing yourself offline and through different strategies. We can talk about whatever you want in this 20-minute session. And again, all you have to do is go to Apple Podcasts, write a written review, send that to info@chelseareif.com, and I will enter you into the giveaway to win that 20-minute laser coaching session with me. All right, so let's get into it. How to travel full-time. I broke this out into tactical sections as well as more mindset and philosophical areas. So I think first things first, how do you even decide where to go? First off, this is obviously very personal. I have no desire to go to certain countries that other people might be dying to go to because their ancestors are from there, or their great-great-grandmother, or they saw a movie and now they have to see where the main character lived. So this is completely personal, understanding where you want to go. I think what you need to know is what are the rules for going to that country and how long you can stay. For example, Americans can stay in the Schengen zone for 90 days, but not every country in Europe is in the Schengen zone. For example, I'm in Albania right now. Albania is not part of the Schengen zone. And from what I've read, Americans can be here for up to a year without a visa. So technically what I'm on is what you would call like a tourist visa, but I don't have to fill out paperwork. So I think this is a huge mystical thing that people think about when they're traveling full time is, oh my gosh, I have to get paperwork or a visa, or I have to apply for residency. I don't have residency anywhere outside of the United States. I don't have citizenship outside of the United States. I only have a US passport. I don't have a dual passport. I don't have a freelance permit anywhere. I don't have like second citizenship. And so I go to countries where the tourist visas are more extended. So again, Albania is a good example. In Cape Town, I know you can stay there for 3 to 6 months. In the UK, you can stay there for up to 6 months without a full-on resident permit or visa or anything. But again, you need to look this up. The rules constantly change. There was just an article that came out a few months ago, actually, that the Schengen zone is going to require paperwork now and a quick fee. So I don't think it's going to take long. It's probably a 10-minute affair where you just fill out a form and pay like, I don't know, I think it was like $10 or something. But that's important. You don't want to get to border control and have them be like, excuse me, where's your paperwork? And have you paid this fee? And you're like, I don't know what you're talking about. And then have to cancel your whole trip or stay in the airport and get questioned and take forever at customs. Like, you just need to Google things and look ahead. I would say instead of Googling as well, because to be honest, sometimes the press comes out with things before the country's even ready for it to come out. A good example is in Portugal, the digital nomad visa that was rolling out. They didn't really have the infrastructure at the office to be able to handle the amount of influx that came in for those applications. So the press came out, including completely reputable sources like Forbes, about this digital nomad visa. But when you actually went to the government website or office, they were like, that's not actually ready yet. Like, that's coming out in a few months and we don't even have the laws for it. So I remember applying and hiring a company to help me. And they're like, that visa is not even open yet. So just a note, instead of looking at the press and Googling, you know, how long can I stay in Romania, go to the government website of that country and find out. Another way you can find out is joining expat groups. So when I was traveling through Australia, I was in a ton of expat groups. things like Bondi Beach backpackers or expats in Australia, expats in Sydney. There are literally a million Facebook groups for things like this. And there's more niche Facebook groups for if you have a certain hobby or mindset or your actual background. So instead of expats in Australia, there might be another group called Americans in Australia or American podcasters in Australia or women in wellness in Australia. So you can find all these niche groups usually on Facebook. There's a lot of Slack channels, Discords, etc. But I found these really helpful to not only ask questions, but ask what companies were helping these people. So when I did try to apply for that Portugal visa, I knew I was not going to be able to do that on my own. And I was able to ask this Facebook group full of people that had just done the same thing, what companies they used, what it was like going to the office, what did they say about the paperwork. And I got all this insight. And that's when I realized this visa is actually not ready yet. So I should wait. That was a whole other story about how I ended up canceling the whole process. And I'm still trying to close my bank account in Portugal. It's been like 6 months. So this is what I'm saying. You don't always want to just jump into what you read in the press. Go to the government website, and honestly, if you're really unsure, call them. Call the direct government department that deals with tourist visas or resident visas or whatever you're looking to do and see what the rules are. I think another factor that helps when deciding where to go is understanding the climate and what type of year you're going. So I love the summer. I'm a big, big fan of the sun. Love being by the water. I'm originally from Florida. My mom is from Puerto Rico. We grew up by the beach. And so that's just something I'm used to and constantly seeking out. Now, if I were to go to Cape Town during what I would consider a USA summer, that's actually the worst time to go because it's their winter. So if I didn't look that up and I just assumed, oh, yay, July and August, summer months, and then I landed in Cape Town, I would be completely miserable because I'd probably be wearing a hoodie and a beanie cap and fuzzy socks, and that's not the vibe that I was originally looking to go to. So it's really important that you don't just assume wherever you live that the seasons are the same everywhere. Also, side note, climate change, like things are way fucking hotter than you would think. The seasons are unpredictable. There's a lot of shifts that happen that you just can't expect. I just went on this retreat in Greece and they ran a retreat, the same one, the week before, and it rained the entire time. So you just don't really know all the time, but I will say you do know when the seasons are in a lot of these countries. So don't try to chase the sun when it's actually the winter in Australia, for example. So that's a huge factor for me. I think also understanding the currency and cost of living. So part of the reason that I haven't spent a ton of time in Scandinavian countries like Denmark is because they are really high costs of living. Going to the grocery store and getting weekly groceries could cost you over $100, where in Albania right now, I could get weekly groceries for $25, right? That's like a 4 times cost difference. Going out is a lot different. I don't want to pay $18 for a mocktail when I could probably get one for $5 in another country. So you really need to understand the cost of living of where you're going. Again, groups like the expat groups I was talking about will help you. Google will help you. I usually ask friends that have gone there too. So I do have a friend that lives in Denmark and she was able to give me the whole 411 before I ever traveled there. If I don't have a friend there, I'll ask communities that I'm in. So for example, I'm in a company that I've traveled with called Remote Year. I'm in this Slack channel and I'll literally just ask people, hey, I've never been to Romania. Can someone give me general prices of what food costs and what can I expect to pay for an apartment and where's the best spot to stay and how much would it cost me to go to the grocery store? Like I ask these things in these groups and people will always help me out. Now, just like with anything, the more you travel, the more you pick things up and you just start to understand what countries are more expensive and what's not. You start to listen to people. You can gauge people's lifestyles and be like, okay, wow, I can see that, you know, there's a lot of backpackers in this country, which probably means it's cheaper because backpackers are usually doing a budget style travel. So maybe I want to go there and just find my own Airbnb versus living somewhere like Sweden where the cost of living is very high. For me, for an American, right? Like this is also very relative. You could think Sweden's pretty cheap if you're from Denmark. So this is all relative. And by the way, I'm speaking from my experience. I'm from the United States. I'm from Central Florida. And I'm from a town called Satellite Beach, which is very small, a very average, like middle class cost of living, right? Like lunch is 10 to 20 bucks. You can get a beer for $5. You can get dinner for like $15 to $20. So this is my perspective. I'm not coming from New York or LA. And so you might go to Denmark if you're from New York and be like, oh, this is very similar. Or London is actually cheaper than New York if you're from New York. So again, just keep in mind that I am speaking from my specific experience. And I think one of the last factors to consider when you're figuring out where to go is how big is a language barrier and how comfortable are you with not knowing the language? Also, are you willing to learn some basic phrases or immerse yourself in learning? Are you comfortable using Google Translate or figuring out a translator app and being patient and not embarrassed or not frustrated? I've traveled with friends that will be transiting through an airport that doesn't speak the language, and they'll get so frustrated that workers at the airport don't speak English. And they're like, well, they work at an airport. They should speak all these languages. And don't they, you know, English is the basic language, da 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 da. Yes and no. We're still in an airport that's in another country that's not our home country or native country. So they're not going to just be whipping out English to accommodate us, even if they are bilingual, because it's not natural for them. Just the same way, I'm not going to whip out all this German when I barely know German. I know how to say like three things in German. So I'm not going to go through a German airport and just switch to speaking German when all I know how to say is like, how, you know, do you have oat milk? Like, that's silly for me to think that I'm just going to switch to German. So you have to put yourself in the perspective of other people where if it's not their native language, it's pretty hard to just switch over and speak English if it's not something they're using all the time. So you need to consider the language barrier. For example, I really want to go to Japan. This is on my 2024, maybe 2025 list. I'm really pushing for 2024. And something I'm very cognizant of is I don't know any Japanese. I don't know anything about the Japanese language. I don't know how to read it. I don't know any words. I don't know anything, right? So for me, I would look at going to Japan in two ways. I should learn some basic phrases that I'm always going to ask. How do you get to blank? Or do you have decaf, right? I can't drink caffeinated coffee. It kills me. Do you have almond milk? How do I get to the bus? Like, things that I know I'm going to ask strangers in public, I probably should learn or have the phrases written down or something. But going in blind and just being like, well, they should speak English because English is the universal language and I'll figure it out, I think that's a very ignorant perspective to go in with. And people aren't really willing to help you if you're not even willing to try to learn a little bit of their language. Now, of course, there's countries that are way more hospitable than others, but I find if you even try a little bit to show like, hey, I learned how to say, how are you? Or I learned how to say this food, they appreciate that and they're more likely to go out of their way to help you. Also, just showing that you took some initiative. Like, hey, I know where I'm at. I know I'm in the city center, but I actually don't know how to get to my Airbnb because my Wi-Fi isn't working. Can you help me out? And like showing them that you took the initiative and being able to read body language and understand body language. This is a whole other conversation, probably about cultures, but this is where patience comes in. And again, being open to the fact that you're probably not going to know the language and you need to know your comfortability level. So if you're like, actually, I don't really want to learn a language. I just want to experience some foreign culture, but go to a place that speaks some English, then pick bigger cities or places in Europe, for example, that there's a whole community of expats and people that can help you out. So for example, Berlin, full of expats. New York City's not abroad, but FYI, it's full of expats and people that immigrated. I think any big city in Europe, Paris, Madrid, Barcelona, Copenhagen, all these places have English speakers. And if you think about it too, places that have companies that have branches in the US will definitely have English speakers in that native country as well. So for example, Spotify is not actually from the US, right? The founder, I believe, is Swedish, but Spotify is huge in the US. So you can just assume that there's probably English speakers in Sweden because it has such a big tech culture and design culture. And these people travel all over the world and have students from all over the world that go to their countries to learn. So they do have a lot of English speakers. So again, you need to do research on this. You can ask different communities. You can Google it, listen to this podcast, but going in blind, just assuming they're going to speak your language is not the way to go. Okay. So now you decide where you want to go, right? I'm going to use my example as Japan throughout this whole thing because it's something I'm actively working on right now. So now you need to decide where you're going to live. I use Airbnb for 95% of my travels. I will say in the last year, I've been to probably 10 different places and 8 of those were with Airbnb. The other part of the way I travel is with group travel companies. One of them is called Remote Year. It's very similar to like studying abroad for adults. They set you up with accommodation, a co-working space, activities, a group chat, etc., and they help with housing and everything. Now, they just changed their tiers, by the way, so you could find your own housing and still have access to the community element, which is something I'll probably do because I like picking my own Airbnbs, but you can choose companies like this that will eliminate a lot of those headaches for you. That's why I like to use companies like that when I'm going to a place where I don't really know the area. So, for example, Japan, Remote Year is something that is on my list that I'm considering because I've never been there and I don't want to go in blind and feel like I'm just wasting time figuring things out when this company has already figured it out and has local people on the ground. And another way I've lived is co-living. There is a place called Neighborgood in Cape Town, and co-living is almost like being in college dorms, but they're not dorms. They're like nicer apartments. You're just all in the same place. And generally, it's people that are working remote or digital nomads. So for example, the Neighborgood place in Cape Town, half the group was remote workers and then half of them were entrepreneurs. We all had our own rooms, right? I had my own bathroom, my own TV, my own bedroom. I had my own room, but then the common spaces were communal. So then I had a kitchen that I shared with everybody. The fridge was shared with everybody. The outdoor area was shared with everyone. There was a cafe that everyone went to inside the place. So that's called co-living. And you can actually just Google places like this. There's a ton of it. I was just Googling stuff the other day because I really want to go to the south of France. And I've only been there a few times very briefly. And so I'm like, you know what? I do want community, which I'll get to in a second. But I want community and I want a place where I feel like people around me are very creative or working remote or doing the same thing as me. So I don't feel so alone. So I found this website called co-living.com, and there were literally French castles that you could co-live in with people. Okay, so this is why traveling is so much fun to me, because I'm like, you're telling me I could live in a castle in the south of France with 8 other digital nomads or remote workers for a month and basically pretend we're like princesses in a castle. Like, what? It's just insane. So go look things like that up. It's really cool when you go down that rabbit hole and see how much really exists, that there's, you know, Greek villas that you can just share with people that have infinity pools and it's overlooking the ocean on a mountaintop. And there's some in the Swiss Alps and you're literally living by ski slopes and you go skiing every day and then co-work by the fire. So that's something that I think is going to be a bigger part of my life in my upcoming travels, because I go through phases where I'd love to travel alone. And I also love traveling with other people, but having my own space. So co-living is a great option. There's also websites I would check out, like Outsite, Hackers Paradise, Wi-Fi Tribe. These are all remote working / co-living sites as well. Okay, so now you're like, yes, I know where I'm going to go. I know how long I can stay. I understand language barriers. I got my Airbnb, or I signed up with something like Outsite or Remote Year or whatever. Now, the time zone is going to change. Most likely, right? Unless you're doing like a road trip around America and you live in America. I'm talking pretty much today about traveling abroad full time, but the time zone is going to change. So you need to figure out your schedule and how to manage the time that you have to work with. So to me, I feel like there are 3 scenarios to walk through. The first one is that you're self-employed, and so you create your own schedule based on what you want to do. Tools that you can use to help schedule yourself are things like Calendly or Acuity. I use a Calendly very religiously. I feel like it helps me guard my calendar, and you set up your availability. So this is trial and error, by the way. I never figured this out on the first try. And to be honest, I've been traveling for several years and I still change around my schedule. But I noticed something that I love doing is being ahead of my clients. So this is a big decision on where I go, is I don't mind being 6 to 9 hours ahead of the majority of my clients because it gives me my mornings to create. So right now, my mornings are full on me time, creativity. I don't schedule meetings. I don't even think about getting online or checking Gmail or anything, because most of my clients are in the US and I know they're not even awake yet. So that actually does play a big part on where I choose to travel. And then I use Calendly to help me block off times and dates that I want to meet with people. I also use Google Calendar to block off personal times. So for example, Calendly will show my clients when I'm available to meet with them, but then I need to also manage my time in my calendar of when I want to work on these creative projects. So for example, right now I'm working within a block that I've called podcasting. So for the last 2 hours, I've been outlining and now I'm recording this podcast, and it's because I scheduled it in my calendar. That's not going to show up in something like Calendly, but Calendly and GCal integrate. So Calendly knows right now that no one can book with me. which is amazing, right? So when I personally block off this 2-hour block, a client actually cannot book with me because of the software. So definitely get your software tools in place. They're there to help you. And again, I consider them like guardians of your calendar. The second scenario here is that you can work remote and you have to work out the hours with your boss. So full transparency, I never did this in my old job. I just took PTO. But most of the people I travel with when I travel with companies like Remote Year, they are remote workers and they have to discuss this with their boss. Now, Remote Year and other websites like this, they have webinars and scripts to help you get approval from your manager. So I can link those resources in the show notes or just DM me or email me. Again, I don't have a lot of advice on this because I was never in this position. I worked in corporate America for 6 years, and that whole time, whenever I did travel, it was just taking like 8 to 10 days of PTO. I never did the full-on remote work for a month thing. So probably not the best person to ask, but again, that's why websites like Remote Year and Hackers Paradise and Wi-Fi Tribe and all these places exist so that you can figure that out and get that approval from your boss. By the way, most people do this now. This isn't like a crazy concept. It's actually very normal. So if you can prove the evidence to your boss of how you're going to use your time and productivity and how you're going to schedule your day and manage everything, they're more likely to approve it when you show them the plan. And then the third option here is with either of these, whether you're self-employed or you have a job that you have to report to someone, you just take off a period of time and not work. And instead, you just explore. To me, this is basically vacation, right? That's like what PTO is, or when you take a vacation is you're not working so that you can explore. But what I will say is digital nomads, we do take off longer periods of time. So we do tend to take longer weekends or build in 3-day weekends into our calendar or take off a month. It's something I just did personally. So I just took off a lot of time when I was in Greece and Albania, partially for a retreat that I was on. I didn't want to be working, obviously, when I was booking a luxury retreat. And the second part of that was I had been nonstop working at a pretty high level in terms of just like very 10 out of 10 energetic level commitment projects where it just required a lot of brain power and energy. And so I needed a moment to slow down. So what I did is I took off like client facing stuff. So I would consider it like a front facing sabbatical. I wasn't launching. I wasn't doing a ton of meetings. I wasn't doing collaborative meetings. I wasn't, you know, doing discovery calls. Like everything was just off the books. And I was able to do that because of looking at my calendar and using things like Calendly, blocking it off, making it very clear to everyone I worked with what the schedule was so that I could be able to take that time off. And this is something that I'm also considering for Japan. I know Japan has a wild time zone difference from a lot of the clients I work with. And I know this is a big limitation when people go travel to Asia. If they're from North America, they're like, I just can't do it because you would have to work overnight. What I will say to this is I started my business in Australia, which is almost the same time zone as, I think it is the same time zone as Asia. So I actually got really lucky in learning how my calendar worked in Australia. I was always like 12 to 14 hours ahead of my clients. And so I feel like I do have a little bit of an advantage here because I worked in Australia first and then Germany second. So for over a year and a half, my business was already set up in a way where I wasn't on the same time zone as my clients. So this is why I'm speaking from this from a bit more experience and a bit more flexibility is I know how to set up my schedule now to be in weird time zones and make it work. Now, part of this is you probably will have to sacrifice a little bit of your routine with your schedule. So like I said in an earlier bullet, I usually work like 12 to 6. That's my prime working hours or at least client facing hours. I know when I go to Asia, that's not going to be the case. I might have to take a really early morning meeting or a really late meeting. There's actually a podcast swap I have coming up where we're doing the swap at like 11 p.m. and midnight. Obviously, that's not ideal, right? I would not want to do that every single night, meeting with clients or doing podcasts at 10 or 11. But that's part of the lifestyle is you meet people from all over the world. We're all on different time zones. And in my opinion, this lifestyle is only going to get bigger and bigger. People are realizing that you don't need to buy a home and settle down for 30 years. You could literally travel the world and naturally your network is going to be in different time zones. So understanding your schedule and how to back it out in a way that works for you is imperative. You cannot just be like, oh, I'll figure it out when I get there. That's highly unadvisable, at least in my opinion. So if you want to go to Japan like I do, let's say in spring, I'm already now in October thinking of what my schedule will look like in April of 2024. So I'm either going to be blocking off April 2024. I'm probably going to tell clients we're not going to be working together in April 2024, or I'm going to be very clear that these are the windows I can work with you. If you can't make that work, that's totally fine. We can start before or after that, but April is just not in the cards right now. So this requires a lot of planning, which I'll get to in a second, and financial planning, but understanding your time and your schedule is honestly one of the biggest things that you need to understand if you're going to travel full time. All right, my next point is about minimalism. Now, this is personal, but I find it incredibly hard to travel when I have tons of stuff. Last year, I traveled with a full big suitcase, like a pretty big one, an away carry-on, like the rolly ones that you just bring right on the plane, and then the weekender bag from base. So it's like a sturdier duffel bag, if you will, and then my laptop backpack. It was way too much for the level I was traveling at. In January, I was in Cape Town. In February, I was in Colombia. In March, I was in Argentina. In April, I was in Peru. In May, I was in Mexico. Okay, that's already 5 different countries in 5 months. Can you imagine traveling with all the stuff that I just told you about on that quick of a schedule? And by the way, some of these places weren't even a full month. Some of these places I went to for like 3 weeks, 2.5 weeks, and then I just had to pick up and go. And within these countries, we would do weekend trips and side trips and constantly be just bopping around. I had way too much stuff. And to this day, I still wish I could travel with less. I made the huge mistake of shopping before I went to New York City. I knew that I was going to be going to a ton of events and meeting with other podcasters and authors and going to book launches and just very creative events that I wanted to look the part. And so I got myself a vest and a long sleeve button down and different types of wedge shoes and different cool sneakers. And I was just really to embody this like New York City fashionista archetype. And now I have a lot of stuff that I don't wear that often. I'm not wearing the vest when I'm walking around the sidewalks of Albania. I'm definitely not wearing the shoes anywhere here. It's also like summertime weather here. So it's actually quite annoying to travel with all this stuff. And for me, this is a huge downside. And I find it very hard to use fashion and express myself with any type of fashion with the limited luggage space that I have. So if you want to travel full time and at the pace that I'm talking about, where you're moving like every 4 to 12 weeks, I do think you need to figure out what you really essentially need and cut the rest. You don't need the platform shoes. You don't need the neon green sparkly dress that you wore once on New Year's because you think you're going to go to a club. You don't need a ball gown in case you get invited to a gala. Like, you don't need that stuff. And by the way, if you need it, you can buy it, have someone bring it to you. I have so many mules. I call them mules because they always bring me books or tech stuff that's not sold here or headphones or something that I just can't access. This is, again, the beauty of traveling full-time is you end up meeting a network of people that no matter where you go, you can find someone to help you out. Like, I literally booked Saranda, Albania as a complete isolation getaway. And as soon as I got here, my friend that I was just traveling with around South America for 4 months ended up being here as well. He's here for 3 weeks. So I was like, okay, this is perfect. And then in 2 weeks, I have another visitor that saw I was going to be here. And she's like, wait, I've always wanted to go there. And so she booked a trip. So actually, my whole 6 weeks in Albania, I'll only be alone for about 2 weeks, which proves my point that, again, no matter where you go, you have this network of people. And the girl that's coming to visit, she's bringing this book and this journal that I can't get here because I'm in this beach town. There's not Amazon Prime. If there are bookstores, they definitely do not have this book. And so I needed her to bring me this stuff. And so this is the point of minimalism too, is like you need to find people to help you if you are going to be minimalist. And you need to consider that now I have these extra books that are definitely going to weigh my luggage down. And I probably should sell them or get rid of them or donate them when I leave this country, because it really does impact your weight. And paying extra luggage fees is not fun. It is the least fun part about traveling. And we'll talk about that in a second when we get to finances. So yeah, consider being more minimalist if you're going to travel full time. All right, why don't we talk a little bit about attitude, right? I gave you a lot of tactical tips, but I think we need to talk about the attitude of being adaptable and flexible and patient. The truth of traveling full time is most of the time, things will not go exactly as you'd imagined. Your flat is going to be in a weird part of town. The shower will have low pressure that will feel like it's just dripping little droplets on you, barely cleaning you. Or it'll be freezing cold, or sometimes it'll be piping hot, and sometimes it doesn't even turn on. you'll be far away from the city center and have to walk 30 minutes with grocery bags because there's actually not public transportation, or you accidentally booked the flat during rainy season and it's pouring every single day. So this is why planning ahead is so essential and putting yourself in communities to help eliminate all of this research. For example, I'm in the Remote Years Slack community. It's an unofficial Slack, by the way. It's something that someone in the community started, and then when you go on a trip, a lot of us just send the link to each other. So I'm in this Slack channel where if I don't know anything about a country or I need help, I will literally post it in that channel. I remember when I was trying to figure out where to go after Mexico, I really wanted to go to an isolated island, and I wanted to go somewhere in the Mediterranean that I hadn't been. And so I asked people, you know, what are some islands in Italy or Greece or places that I'm not even considering I could go to? And what's been your experience there? And people are really honest, like, hey, beautiful water, but by the way, there's no public transportation. Or it's beautiful, but it has a ton of hills and you're walking up and down a hill every single day to run errands. So you need to keep that in mind. Or they don't value X, Y, and Z. And so the culture is a little bit different and you have to get used to that. An example right now is I'm in Albania in Saranda. It's a beach town. Everyone, like literally everyone, smokes cigarettes. I'm looking out on my balcony right now and there's an ashtray for if I smoked. Every cafe I go to, people are smoking. People are smoking outside. Some places allow you to smoke inside. Whenever I go to an outdoor cafe, I go by the water purposely to like get away from the smoke, and everyone is smoking there. And then the sea breeze just completely brings that secondhand smoke to me. Okay. So this is something that I wasn't really expecting, right? But I remember people telling me about this, like, oh, by the way, like there's a lot of people that smoke there. I would have never known that. That's not really something you're going to Google and just immediately get the first answer. You're going to have to do a little bit of digging. Now, you actually could Google that, right? Like, is this country known for smoking? Or is this country known for XYZ? Or what are they known for? So you get a bit of a feel for it. So you definitely have to be adaptable and understand that your vision is probably not going to be executed the exact way you wanted it to. There's another site called Nomad List that I'm going to sign up for. I've heard it's incredible. And from my understanding, it's this huge community that has safety levels of where to go, the Wi-Fi levels of like, yeah, this is a great country, but the Wi-Fi sucks. So, you know, don't be expecting to Zoom or do any remote type of podcasting. Or, you know, this place is actually amazing for female solo travelers. Girls love it. They can just walk at night and feel safe. And this place isn't so much. Like, you always need to walk with a buddy. So I'm going to sign up for Nomad List. And I also follow a lot of accounts on Instagram. So whether that's Nomad accounts or these like group travel accounts, I follow them and I just try to see who they tag and who's featured and who's in the comments and stalk them. I usually do that. And I Google co-living spaces. So like I said, the ones that I was just looking up were castles in France. Do I know if I'm going to do that? Not sure yet. I think it would be a really hilarious and fun story. But again, I really love being by the water and I don't know if being in like an isolated castle in the middle of nowhere is really the move for me. But that's the point of being flexible and patient and planning, is that I can take the time to be like, let me think through this before I just impulsively book a castle in France. The great thing about a lot of these communities too is a huge piece of the load will be offset when you're around other people. So right now in Albania, I'm lucky that I do have a friend here. And if he wasn't here, I would be figuring out a lot of things by myself. So not only do I have to figure out where I'm living, the currency, etc., I also have to consider my business, right? Is the Wi-Fi good? Are there co-working spaces? Do the cafes allow digital nomads? By the way, there are some countries where they're not that open to digital nomads. I've been to places where they're like, no, no laptops, laptop-free zone. We don't have Wi-Fi. Sorry, you can't sit there for more than an hour. So you should look that up as well if you're trying to be a digital nomad. And that's something that I've now considered too, is like, is this actually a good place to travel for my business? Or do I need to maybe just go for a week, explore, see the beach, and then head out to a place that's maybe more open? So being adaptable, being flexible, and being patient are truly three personality traits that you need to adopt now if you want to travel full time. All right, I know this one is the one you've all been waiting for, is finances. I feel like finances is the most mystical part of traveling full time. Because raise your hand if you're like me and you see anyone that goes to Europe as living a very luxurious life. I don't know if that's just how I grew up, but I just considered anyone that went to Europe as very wealthy. I was like, wow, my God, they did a week-long trip to Europe. Like, that must have cost thousands and thousands of dollars. And oh my God, they're sitting at this cafe in Paris and they're right by the Eiffel Tower. Like, that must have been so expensive. And how the hell does anyone travel like this? I'm here to tell you, I honestly will say this with like 99% confidence. I think I save a lot more money and get way more out of my income than I did in the United States. So let me get into it. When I was in Australia, which by the way was 2019, to add some context, I quit my job in 2019. I worked in a corporate American company doing influencer and content marketing. It was going really well, by the way. I was making six figures. I was a manager. I was working with the world's top brands and media agencies. I was selling huge deals, but I was just not happy and not content. And I knew there was a bigger life out there for me. So I was like, you know what? I'm going to figure this out. And so I went to Australia, which has a working holiday visa. So that's an amazing visa, by the way. If you're listening, you're not really sure where to go, and you're an American or an English speaker, go look at the working holiday visa in Australia, because it gives you a whole year there to work and holiday, as it says in the name. And it's for people, I think, up to 35 or 36. When I did it, it actually only allowed up to 30-year-olds. And now they change it to be, I think, up to 35 or 36. So you need to check that out because it's such an easy visa. And it's kind of like the gateway drug into traveling full time, because it allows you to go explore somewhere else, but with an English speaking country. And it's beautiful. The beach is there, the parks, the nature. It's somewhere I actually want to go back. And yeah, I think you should just check out the working holiday visa in Australia if you're curious about this. So that was my gateway drug into traveling full time. And the way the finances worked for that is I actually saved up for an entire year and lived with my parents and my friends for a very low cost of rent that helped me out. So when I lived with my parents, I think I was there maybe for like 5 months. Did not pay rent. So any money that I would have paid on rent, I just put into a savings account. And then I lived with some friends in their guest room and I paid a very low cost of rent, like honestly $200 or $300, like something ridiculously low. When I'm not paying such a huge chunk to my rent, that can go into my savings account. Now, full admission, I'm not the best saver. I am a spender. I definitely keep the economy going. I used to have a very bad spending habit where I would just make money and blow it. So I could have honestly saved like 2 to 3 times the amount of money than I did when I went to Australia. And instead I went with probably like $6,000 or $7,000. Again, I'm almost laughing saying that number because the amount of money I made for the amount of rent I was saving on does not really match. And I think this shows you what I was spending on, which I will get to in a second, was a lot of things that I was doing to keep up with the lifestyle of people I hung out with. So I had a personal trainer, I would get expensive food, we would eat out all the time, I would get wine every single time I went out or just to have at the house. I got my nails done, I got massages, I got facials. So yeah, I didn't actually save that much money, but that did help me save more money than it would if I was paying rent, right? By the way, I was also in sales, and so I was expecting a huge commission check to come in. I basically banked on this commission check that would have probably doubled or tripled my savings. And what happened is the company paid late, and by the time they paid, I wasn't a legal employee anymore, and so I didn't get the commission check. And so it was a blessing in disguise in a way, because it forced me to budget out what I had saved better. I didn't have the money to keep me afloat for the time that I wanted to, and it just lit a fire under me to find a job when I needed to. So that's how I went to Australia. And the beauty of the currency change was that it was $6,000 US, but it was like 10 or 11,000 Australian dollars. So the US dollar when I went in 2019 was stronger than Australian dollars, which means it did actually keep me afloat longer than honestly I expected it to. I also spent a huge portion of that money on a yoga training in Bali. So flights to Bali, the training itself was not cheap. And then on weekends, we'd go travel around Bali. So that's where a huge chunk of it went. And then when I got back, the money went to living, right? I needed to find an apartment. I needed to get groceries. And I spent a lot of it on partying too. I really was the first 6 months in Australia, just like, let me see what it's like to not have a job when I'm in my 20s. And I went pretty crazy those first 6 months. And then I finally was like, okay, you should probably learn how to budget and manage your money. So that's just like how my finances went in Australia. Not that great, to be honest. I think the best thing I did was just save and live with my parents and have a low cost of rent. Then when I went on my remote year trip, which was a 4-month trip to Cape Town, Valencia, Lisbon, and Croatia in Split, I actually did live at home for a longer period of time. Now, part of living at home and even what propelled me to go on remote year was a breakup. And so I wasn't expecting to just move out of Germany and, you know, abruptly have to pick up the pieces of my life and figure it out. And I actually thought I would stay in Germany longer because I had a permit. So I was going to live in Berlin or Hamburg and just get an apartment there. And the way it worked out was just like, it wasn't worth it to me. So instead of figuring this out and paying all this money with a business that was brand new, I was like, let me just go home and reset and regroup. So while I was at home for almost 8 months, I found Remote Year, which was this travel company. And then I figured out the costs. And so I was able to save a lot for that trip, again, by living at home and planning ahead. The way Remote Year worked as well was you put down a deposit, which came out of the total payment, and then you paid like partially a bit of it 2 months before your trip even started, and then you have 4 monthly payments. So you don't pay all of it up front. You actually pay it probably over like 6 or 7 payments, to be honest, and they're willing to work with you. So that's something that I would say when you're looking to any of these things, whether that's an Airbnb, Remote Year, Outsite, anything. Ask if they can help you. Ask for a custom payment plan, or can we change the schedule up a little bit? Can I pay at this date versus this date? Most people are willing to work with you. What I will say about my trip was that whole concept of you are who you hang out with, right? Like you are the 5 people you hang out with. That definitely kicked in, and my group was bougie. They all had airport lounge access. They had priority pass, Uber Black. They did not take shared car rides. They did not take cabs. They did not like to wait in line. They liked tables at the club, VIP. I mean, it's like makes me laugh that my group of 26 of us, I think, was just so next level. And so my spending, I just told you I was a spender. My spending like doubled or tripled. And I ended up spending so much money on Remote Year. I actually took out a 0% APR credit card before I went on the trip in case of any type of emergencies, like if I wanted to fly home or if I needed to like quit the program and get an Airbnb, anything. I was just like, this is my emergency credit card. You're not really going to use it. That didn't happen. I ended up racking up that credit card on everything, on beach club cabanas, on VIP, on a shuttle bus, on wristbands, on shots. Like I was reckless, to be honest. I that was a very bad idea. That was very irresponsible, and I'm still paying it off. And guess what? That interest just kicked in. So do not take that advice. That was something that I learned the hard way, is that those 0% APR credit cards will get you, because in your mind, you're like, I have 18 months to pay this off. So I'll just set up a payment plan and pay it off. That usually doesn't work. Let me not say usually, I'll speak for myself. That doesn't work for me because I work a lot with urgency and procrastinating. And so I kept putting the monthly payments off. And then eventually I was like, oh, I think my 0% offer runs out pretty soon. And then I checked and they're like, yeah, it ends next month. I'm like, oh, great, amazing. So now I'm going to be paying that off with definitely some interest. So do not do that. That's an example of what not to do. That experience, though, taught me how I need to set up my finances and budget. So I think with every rock bottom moment we learn and we can hopefully take something away from it. I've done that a few times before. That's not the first time I've been impulsive and got myself into credit card debt. And I was like, you need to fix this, because this is not a trait to have when you're running a business. Or if I want a future family, or I want a partner that has their finances together, like I need to work on my finances. And so I started realizing, how can we make this better? And I set up all my clients where every single one is on a payment plan. So when I'm traveling, even if I'm not doing a live launch, I am fine to cover my basic expenses. I also choose to live in countries that have a lower cost of living, but a high quality of life. Cape Town is a great example. Cape Town has a beach, it has mountains, it has nature, it has vineyards that look like Napa. You can go on safaris, you can go on road trips. They have a city center, they have a creative community, they have an athletic community. Like there's so much going on there. So again, you can live a very high quality of life and your rent could be $1,000 or less, which to me is cheap because I used to live in Chicago, which was not cheap at all, right? My rent was like $1,600 back in 2017 or something. I was making like no money, literally making pennies. So for me, I like to keep my rent around 1,000, and that's personal. I have friends that they make more money or they value Airbnbs or where they live differently, right? They're like, no, I refuse to have this, or I absolutely have to have this. And so their budgets might be like $2,000, which will obviously get them a different quality of apartment. So this is totally personal. This is just how I do it. And sometimes I do get lucky and find a great deal. For example, I'm in Albania right now. I think it's because they're heading into the off season and the town I'm in is really not a place where digital nomads come. I was able to secure the place I'm staying right now for 6 weeks at $740. $740 for a month for me is already cheap, let alone 6 weeks. It may have even almost been seven. If you backed out the math, it's like $17 or $18 a night, which is actually cheaper than most youth hostels. I have a balcony. I'm looking at the ocean right now. The balcony actually wraps around so I can go in the shade. I do yoga on the side. I have my own bedroom. There's air conditioning in the bedroom and in the kitchen. I have a full kitchen. I have a fridge. I have hot water. Like, I have a washer. I have everything. So to me, I struck gold with this. And this does happen once in a while where you're like, whoa, I can't believe this worked out. So now with the extra money I have, I can pay off my debt that I racked up on remote year. I can use it on business expenses. I can save more money. And this is a huge, huge piece of how I plan my travels. The one thing I'll say, going quickly back to the business expenses about setting clients up on a payment plan, is that I can now estimate what the future is going to look like. So what I used to do was let people pay either upfront in full or on the payment plan and give them a type of discount if they paid upfront. So let's just say the program is $5,000. And if they did a payment plan, it's like, I don't know, $1,200 a month or something. But if they paid up front, I would knock a little bit off. So I would say, oh, if you're going to pay up front, I'll either give you money off or I'll give you like a bonus call, some type of incentive for paying in full. This goes back to my spending habits that when I would get paid in full, I would do a good job of saving for my taxes and putting some in savings. But then I would tend to upgrade my lifestyle and be like, oh my gosh, well, now I have all this money. I could go hire a one-on-one health coach, or I could invest in this bigger thing for my business that I've been putting off, or I think I'm going to get a personal trainer, get weekly massages, or whatever the case is. And that's a trait I've noticed about myself, which is something I'm actively working on, is I don't need to spend money every single time I have it in my hand. It's something that travel has taught me too, right? Like, if I'm spending all this money now, it actually takes away from future places. And this is a thing that travelers deal with, is you do have to book a lot of places in advance. This is a downside, which I'll get to some challenges in a second, but there are times where I have to book like four things at once. So I have to book my Cape Town Airbnb for 3 months, the same time I'm booking my November and December travels, while I'm also paying off October travels. So this happens a lot. I remember my friend in Cape Town said he had to pay for his apartment for 6 months up front. You need to save for that, right? You need to understand that it's not the same as America, where you just have your monthly income and it's the same every month and it goes through an auto payment or you pay your landlord. Like, that's not the case at all. And so you really need to understand your finances. So going through that whole period of me recklessly spending on my credit card and paying it off and not understanding when clients are paying, blah, 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 it made me realize I need stability with my monthly revenue. And so I'm actually going to put all my clients on payment plans, even people that want to pay up front. I've had a girl ask, can I just pay you all at once? And I said, I'd actually prefer we do a payment plan. It helps my nervous system regulate. It helps with predictability. I can see into the future. Right now, I can pull up my financial sheet and be like, okay, this is at bare minimum how much money I'm going to make in December. And it helps me back out my travel plans. So if I need to make more money in December because my income is dipping because I haven't been promoting anything, then I know I need to start marketing things in a different way or do a live launch or something like that. And so that is going to affect where I travel, right? I'm probably not going to go book a crazy, adventurous, like adrenaline-filled trip to New Zealand where we're bungee jumping and skydiving and doing all these things if I know that I need to ground down for a second and really focus on my work, because it would just distract me. So these are personal things, by the way, again, very specific scenarios, but I think it helps to just hear kind of what goes on in the mind of a digital nomad and how we plan out where we're going and why. Something that will help your cost of living too is living with other people. So I could be saving a ton of money right now if I lived with someone else. So if you travel with a friend or a partner, this can massively save you money. If you live in hostels, that is 10 times cheaper than living in Airbnbs. If you live further out of the town, right? So if you're like in a main square, that's going to be more expensive than if you're, I don't know, 5 miles out of town. And then lastly, like the amenities that you're looking for. So I notice when I travel, I need to be in a lot of sunlight. Again, I'm from the beach. I need that sunlight to not feel depressed, especially if I'm alone. It can get lonely. And so I need sunlight to make me feel good and cheery and happy. If there is a balcony, I try to book it I really love balconies. I love writing on them. I love doing yoga out there. I love talking to friends on the balconies. So I really try to look for places with balconies. AC and Wi-Fi are important. Washer and dryers are important. Like, my friend and I booked our Mexico City Airbnb because it had a dryer. We're like, we can't believe this. It is a luxury to have a dryer when you are traveling abroad. We literally felt like we were the bougiest people in the neighborhood because we had a dryer. So amenities will add to your cost of living. And so you need to figure out what are your non-negotiables and what you can live with and without with, and then choose your accommodation accordingly. All right. And the last part of part one is community. Personally, I need a digital or physical community to not go insane. I'm in the Remote Years Slack channel, which again is unofficial, like someone from the trip just started it and then a bunch of people join. I'm also in a business membership online. I'm in a writing membership online. I'm in a course. All these places have like Mighty Networks hubs or WhatsApp channels or Discords, whatever. I'm in so many of those. I also am in loads of free communities. And I mentioned this a few weeks ago in my episode about maintaining friendships. I pretty much list all the communities I'm in. But WhatsApp groups are huge. Like when I went to Mexico City, I was in one called, I believe, CDMX Wellness. So many people in there. That's how I went to a magic mushroom sound bath and a breathwork class and dancing in the park. Like so many things I did in Mexico City were from that WhatsApp group. So try to join WhatsApp groups, try to join Slack channels, Discords, Mighty Networks hubs, wherever there's a community element. You are going to find like-minded people in there that will help you feel grounded and safe and that you have friends, because it does get lonely. It can feel isolating. And there are going to be times where you're like, can someone just like come and grab coffee with me and like vent a little bit? And most of the time you can find someone that will join you. All right. So that's part one. So to recap, we talked about how to decide where you want to go, where to actually live, scheduling and time management, being more minimalistic, adapting an attitude of flexibility and patience, setting up your finances accordingly, and community. Part two, I'm going to talk about routines and go-to comforts, the challenges of traveling full-time, as well as the mindset and why do I actually do this? I think when you hear some of the challenges, especially what I just talked about financially and some of the downsides of traveling, you're going to be like, then why do you do it so much? And I definitely want to explain what fuels this. So I would love to hear from you. Let me know what you thought of part one. Was this helpful? What questions do you have? And what do you want to hear in part two? I am very committed to demystifying the whole digital nomad lifestyle. I want to show you that it's possible, whether you do it for 2 weeks, 4 weeks, 3 months, a year, or for the rest of your life. I want to give you more tools and insights into how it actually works. So let me know. There's going to be a poll on the Spotify episode. So if you go over Spotify, please vote or write in, because this is how we can communicate. And don't forget that you can always leave a voice note to the podcast. So there's a link in the show notes where you can literally click on it, go record the voice note. It can be up to a minute long. And what I'll do is actually stitch it in the episode and answer on air. So email me info@chelseareif.com, DM me @chelseareif, even though I have taken a little bit of a step back from Instagram. You can still shoot me a DM there, or write on the Spotify episode and leave a voice message to the podcast with the link in the show notes. All right, I hope this was helpful. Just a reminder, if you leave a review, you will get entered into a giveaway to win a full-on 20-minute coaching session with me. And all you have to do is leave that written review on Apple Podcasts. Just go to Apple Podcasts, go to my podcast, In My Non-Expert Opinion, scroll down the episodes as if you're like just trying to go back to episode one, and you'll see a section where it says write a review. So again, this whole giveaway is for written reviews. So make sure you write it out, screenshot it, and then send it to info@chelseareif.com. You'll be entered into this giveaway. All right. Thanks so much for tuning in. Stay tuned for part two. Can't wait to hear what you think about part one, and I'll see you in the next episode.